Oh, wait, he's coming into focus. There he is, sort of. You're half in the new sphere and half in the real world.
Yes, I'm descending into reality.
All right. How was it on the other side?
Had a reddish tinge to it.
I thought it was supposed to be a white light or a blue light, or
well,
or did you go? Did you go to the other place?
No, I think that's where we spend most of our time anyway. How you been keeping?
Well, it's been a busy week. Like you say, this being retired is tough business.
Isn't it? Isn't it? Oh, yeah. All of a sudden, everybody in the world knows where you are.
I don't have that problem. I'm pretty much of a recluse.
But,
when there's a crisis, they seem to be able to find me.
Yeah.
And, I hop in the Batmobile and ride to the rescue or click a few buttons to send some money somewhere.
Yes.
So those types of things.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. Exactly.
And I wonder, when I run out of money, if
you'll still be liked.
Seriously. If my usefulness is just that, a practical usefulness, and, if I cease to be of use, I'm probably overstating it.
To a certain extent, yes, but I can certainly resonate with the sentiment that's behind it, I can say things like, you're very useful here because I enjoy having our conversations and, your participation and whatnot. And we go, oh, that's really nice. And that lasts all of about 30 seconds when real life comes back in.
Actually, I thought about that. If I failed to show up, would I be missed?
Things
would just carry on, So would you even all have a shot, like we were a platoon or something,
I can guarantee you I would. I don't know who else, maybe throwing them back with me, but I would.
I was, if I was killed in action. I had to provide a useful service for my brother who lives up about 200 miles west of here. Mm-hmm. And I had to rescue him at a parking garage and in near the airport and drive him up to his place, which allowed me to spend the night in this cabin that I built for him about 10 years ago. And I haven't been up there since, actually. So, and the cat, it's just so quiet and the stars and it's very small. And so I was sleeping there and thinking that's probably how it's going to end. I'll be up there sleeping and I'll just die and freeze to death. And 3 or 4 days, somebody will come and check on me and there, I'll be stiff as a board. And, that's how it's going to end.
Oh, okay.
Well, you should at least enjoy the quiet when you have it.
Oh, fabulous.
It's a fabulous thing, isn't it? I was down in Muxica in Spain once, and we were there for a conference, and it was literally in the middle of nowhere. And there's a lot of nowhere in Spain, and this was...
Really?
Yeah. There's a lot of nowhere in Spain. We were up on top of this mountain and this retreat house or whatnot. There was one of our project partners was from Lucerne, Switzerland. And I saw him at breakfast the next morning and he looked rather harried. And I said, I said, you know, what's wrong? You didn't. He goes, I didn't sleep at all last night. I said, well, why not? He goes, have you heard how quiet it is here? And that completely threw him off because there was not even the cows were lowing. You know?
But a lot of people, yeah, are like that. If it is quiet, they need a fan or something.
Yeah, something that makes some noise somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
Can I say? Oh, well. Oh, look who was all here.
There's your noise. Hello, everyone.
How's Hello. Going? Greetings.
Hi, John. I'm Michael. Can't see Michael, though.
Where looks are like, you today, Doug? That looks like a new
Doug background. Doug always has a different background. I think he's got a whole bunch of them, like, at home.
He just moves the screen.
He puts the screens up.
This is a green screen.
The green screen. Okay.
Yeah. He's an undercover agent, so he's probably
yep. Today I'm posing as a student at a local college.
Oh.
So this good. Is one of their rooms here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Are you? Well.
Are we recording?
Yeah, we are.
Oh, okay. That's nice to know.
As soon as somebody shows up, doesn't it start?
Do we have a frame today? Or is it just going to be a free-for-all or something in between? I know you wanted to talk about the future cafes. Is that correct? Somebody?
Well, there was a possibility that we could talk about future readings. We could also talk about future cafes. I have a few topics in mind that I just haven't had the time to write down. And Doug has mentioned a few. I saw an exchange. I forgot which topic, which other thread it was in. But that's one possibility. And there could also be other things that are on our minds that we might want to.
It says agenda items, meta-reflections on CAFE practice itself, procedural issues, tech questions, coordinating upcoming sessions. I think those are all interesting points that maybe we can develop. I'm ready to go with something. Is it okay if I start? Hello? Mm-hmm.
Go on, John.
Sure.
Go for it.
I had a dream.
So did Martin Luther King.
Well,
what happened to him?
He had a much better dream than I did. I'm also Doug and Michael's here. Yeah, Michael and I have recently started a dream alternate knowing group, practice group, basically experiential group. I've been using a lot of clean language questions there, and I think we've had about three sessions. So we're going to have our fourth one tomorrow. So some of what I'm bringing forward today has something to do with that group, because I think a lot of the groups we're members of different groups, and some of the groups form for a short while and then they disperse, and then another group starts, and we have long-term book study groups like Life Divine. How many months is that? 4 or 5 months? We're not finished yet. So I think our cafes have been we meet supposed to meet once a week. They tend to be very topical, or, an essay or an article or a guest. So I think those are when the cafes work the best. They're planned. That's my preference, because I have a very short window of opportunity to make anything happen. And I have to make plans to make anything happen. So I look at the week, I look at the day, I look at the month, I look at the year, and what I can squeeze in. And I'm sure you guys are doing the best you can to manage your time as well. So I love this time together when we've planned on something and our attention is focused and we share. I think the quality of the relationships have made many of these cafes I consider successful. different points of view, diversity. It has a rhythm, everyone has a different style. And except on occasional, there are occasional, I think, riffs. I think, though, that there's enough stability that new people can come in and be welcomed and greeted, and whatever they offer can be a stimulus for further conversations. So with having said all of that, I had a dream last night. And in the dream, there was a panel, because I think this is about, I'm interested in social dreaming, by the way. I'm not that interested in therapy dreaming, you know, where you go and talk to a therapist and have this private conversation that lasts for years about your dreams. I actually am opposed to that kind of use of dreams. I'm wanting to make dreams public. And that's what social dreaming is about. It's organized around dreamers coming together and dreaming about society or the organizations that they're members of. So I believe this is a social dream. And once again, I don't need to have it interpreted. I'm just like, there's a panel discussion going on. Actually, there's no discussion, it's just a panel. They're all sitting at a table and I'm sort of on a podium and I'm sort of below them in a sort of open space with a woman. There's a table in front of us and a woman in a white lab coat. She looks like a doctor. And she proceeds to put a Petri dish of shit on the table. And she starts to proceed to diagnose me with something. I don't know what. But I said, I really don't appreciate you showing my shit to the public. And I woke up thinking, oh, wow, that was a really shitty dream. I want to forget about that one right away. However, in the interests of my own ambition here, I'm interested in exploring this as a topic, not necessarily for today, but for something in the potential future. So as I wondered about what the fuck does this dream, what is this all about? I opened up, I worked with a metanormal capacity, which is to open up a book and put your finger on the first thing that you see. And that's what I did. I opened this book, it's called The Universe of Things. And I opened to this passage. And it says, the answer, I believe, can only be that all entities have insides as well as outsides, or first person experiences as well as observable third person properties. A thing's external qualities are objectively describable, but its interiority is neither a something nor a nothing. As Whitehead puts it, everything in the universe is both public and private. There are elements only to be understood by reference to what is beyond the fact in question. And there are elements expressive of the immediate, private, personal individuality of the fact in question. The former elements express the publicity of the world. The latter elements express the privacy of the individual. So I believe this is a dilemma that I face, and I'm sure that all of us face to some extent, of this what's private and what's public. And Whitehead is basically saying, that's a very fuzzy area. And I'm very aware that, also I wanted to say that sharing my shit in public, I take that risk. There's a shadow side to everybody, and I take that risk. I'm glad you do that. But if someone else wants to monetize other people's shit while hiding their own shit, that's something else again. And I believe we're living in a world that is moving very quickly towards, perhaps, in many ways we probably already are and we don't notice it, moving towards a post-money society. we're not nearly there yet, but I think that some of us are very much longing for that, so that we can bring front and center aesthetic relationships and social justice. I'm also aware that's very visionary talk. That's aspirational talk. That's about, I'm not going to see this in my lifetime. This is about the future. Other people will see the benefits of what we're doing today. But this isn't, I realize, something that everybody is into. So I think there's the realist, of course, who has a plan of action. He or she may want to monetize something. And that's a value that they have, to make money. And I'm all for that. That's a value. But it isn't a mission. It could be a mission, but it certainly is not a vision, because a vision has to do with other people. And so I think there's a conflict here and elsewhere around this dynamic. And it would be my desired outcome would be to be able to differentiate the visionary from the realist, who may hold certain values, but also could confuse my values with your values. I have maybe a task. I want to make some money. But that isn't the task of this group, is to make money for me. So I may be confusing my task with the task of the group. So I think this is a challenge. And I'm just bringing this up because I think it's a big can of worms. I'm opening it up. And you guys may be interested in it or not. We can certainly change the subject and talk about something else, because I think there are a lot of interesting things going on besides just this particular topic. But I think also I want to make clear that I have this other group that we're forming around this social dreaming and alternate ways of knowing. And I think that's a very interesting, it's not a closed group, but it's starting small and we're just working together. We want to develop something that we may be able to present to this group, this cafe, as has been recently done, which I thought was Marco and Heather and Jeffrey worked on a project and they brought it in and had a rehearsal and developed that. And I believe that's a very worthwhile tradition that we should keep moving towards. Using the cafe for that purpose, as well as for hanging out, enjoying relationships, and encouraging others to be at our best, and also dealing with the shadow that we're seeing in ourselves and in the larger culture of which we are all members of this culture, which is in tremendous chaos right now. So I hope we can find some stability so that we can view this in ways that open up possibilities. So thanks.
I have a quick question, John.
Sure.
How did you get to that book?
Oh, it's been on my shelf for years.
Yeah, no, but I mean, what motivated you to pull it off the shelf?
It was I sat at my computer and it was sitting right here on top of The Shape of Ancient Thought. And so I went for this one. I opened it up to page 104, and that was the paragraph. And it talked about first-person experience and third-person properties, the observer, and the clash between private and public, which, you know, we've talked about this before, and I'm sure it's an ongoing theme.
Okay.
It's by Shaviro is his name, Stephen Shaviro.
Okay, thanks.
I would like to just go forward going along with John, that my metaphor that's come to my mind in working with what John's talking about is a metaphor I'm stealing from books, a titled book called Walking in the Shadowed Light. And for me, that metaphor seems to really fit in terms of even going through my daily life and encountering the shadow energy that some people put out and me too, and how I have to interact with it. I do believe that it's a skill set, and I concur that what we're doing on alternate realities and dreams has really brought my skill set of doing that to another level. And it has to do with how I think as a species, how we need to learn to actually embody Marco's vision of this site. I'm so grateful for the site, because it's really actually I've engaged on the street from what I learned from here. So I just want to put that forward as far as the metaphor I'm working with is walking in shadowed light. It's an interesting thing because during the day, there's all kinds of shadows. I'm not shadows anymore. There's a inner mixing of shadow and light that a long time ago, I didn't know how to work with. And sometimes I would bang into things, literally. Anyway, thank you.
I don't mind monetizing on some time here. Did you, Mark, get a chance to explain your extraordinary week that you mentioned?
No, of course not. There's not enough time. John mentioned a whole plethora of things that I could spin on or riff on, but I was looking in my book as you were talking, John, because I had a similar dream of a person in like a lab coat and a petri dish, and I was looking for it, but I couldn't find it, you know. But I thought that was pretty it was recent, so maybe we had it, unless yours was yesterday. I love dreaming. But they're strange, and I write them all down if I remember them. I always write them down, and I use a combination of Jungian theory on dreams and Freudian theory on dreams, and I take a look at them. I usually do not share them, except even in the therapeutic situation, which I'm engaged in, I don't. There's just too much going on to get bogged down in the dream world. So I think it's fascinating, though. I had one the other day that was incredible, and I wrote. I had some insight because of the dream, and I wrote a short paper. But I haven't shared it with anyone, and I don't know that I will, because I don't know that it matters, really. So, I don't know, you know. But I love the dreaming world, and there's this, when it's a really bad dream, you know, a nightmare, and you wake up, it's really great, because you can say, that was a dream. That's not, it wasn't real. And so your day can get off to a better start, because some dreams can be, you know, like I lose the ability to speak not infrequently in dreams. And then eventually I do come to a waking state. And so I'm just thrilled that I can actually talk. And what was traumatizing me, taking my voice away, is it wasn't real. So, yeah, dreams are a lot of fun.
I think the, just to make a comment briefly, about some of the work that's been done in trauma, and some of this Michael and I have discussed, and I'm sure many of us have, on the pattern of trauma is to fight, flight, or freeze. And freezing is if you can't fight and you can't flee, then you freeze. And I believe we all have had, you know, embarrassing moments in public where we were told to shut up and sit down, or we had that was a dumb question. Or I had a dream and you told a dream and people got silent and told you should not have, that's a bad topic or whatever. So I think we've learned how to freeze. I'm really wanting to balance these different, you know, to create a monophasic culture where we, oh, that was a dream. That wasn't real. Thank God. But what if it is real? And what if this monkey business we're doing in the daily world is bullshit? I suspect much of it is. But I think we need to create some sort of connection between these other phases of consciousness so that a lot of the things that, you know, we don't notice or we miss or we contract around can be brought forward into our social spaces to be cleared, to be laughed at, and to laugh with. I think a lot of dreaming is hilariously funny, but also to give voice to those dimensions which don't speak, but I think are extremely powerful. And most of the time that part of us that doesn't talk is running the show. So anyway, thank you for those comments. I think that's a very important dimension, that part of us that shuts down or wants to control, or just to dismiss and have amnesia for.
I don't think it's they don't these parts don't talk, John. Obviously, they're talking a lot, and they talk very loudly, and they talk very unclearly, for our normal way of dealing with it. I didn't know for the longest time when I was a child growing up that people had what they called nice dreams. Because I never had one. What Mark characterized as bad dreams, those are the only dreams I ever have. They're always nightmares. Now, it doesn't bother me that they're nightmares. That's just how my dreams are. And I know that, and more often than not, in a lot of these things, I simply wake up, and it's not like Mark said, in my case, because it's a kind of standard thing. Oh, that was just the dream. It's for me. Okay, what was the dream? You know, what's this telling me? What's this making me aware of? How do I need to deal with it? I don't write my dreams down because they're always bad. I don't have time to sit down and analyze them. I probably should. But I place a lot of value on what people dream and why they might be dreaming it. Because I always think that they are telling us something. We need to be aware of them. When I am awake after my nightmare, it is often very difficult for me to simply go back to sleep because I know I'll start dreaming where I left off. And I don't want to do that. So I have to stay awake, go through whatever I have to do to, you know, redivert my attention so that I can then go to sleep again. And then something else might pop up as well. So they're obviously telling me a lot. When I say I don't write them down and reflect upon them, it's not that I don't do a systematic study of them. I think that's the way I need to describe that, because I do think about them a lot, and they come back to me. And there are times when I'm awake and I'm doing things that fragments of dreams will float in and out of my consciousness, kind of like a little tap on the shoulder thing that says, oh, by the way, this is what I was, this is what I was talking about. And then it goes away again, you know, that kind of thing. So I agree that the dreams are a very significant part of our existence, and I find it sad that we tend to push them off or that we tend to degrade them or denigrate them in some way. I have one daughter who always has nice dreams. I have another daughter who's just like me. And for years when she was growing up, I had to spend a lot of time with her nights because of her dreams that she had. And explaining them away as them being nothing isn't helpful in situations. No. We had to learn to accept and engage the dreams, regardless of what they are. I didn't know anything about this when this is going on, of course, you know, so you feel your way through the best you can, however you can. She's at least as far as I am now, and she simply accepts that if she's going to dream, it's probably going to be a bad one. But she can accept that now, and she can deal with it in a much different way than, oh my God, what's going on with me? I'm going insane, or, you know, the devil's out to get me, or whatever it is, because I don't think any of that, you know, I'm very much, it's us kind of thing.
So I think this relates to the post on that was done on Buddhism and uncertainty. I don't know how many people checked that out. And Penelope really gave a good articulation of trying to distinguish between uncertainty and ambiguity and chaos. And this whole subject feels like, from all of you, is that human tension of dealing with uncertainty and where do we go with this? You know, how do we relate to it? And I'm on board with both John and Ed, is that from my working with my trauma and Zen Buddhism and centering prayer, the touch point is feeling into the contact of the uncertainty of what's arising. And that it takes a different practice. I do agree, if you do it within your dreams versus your daytime, it's a different kind of practice. I've never been able to master it. I've had a spectrum of dreams gone from nightmare to pleasant to having Beetlejuice show up in my dreams and poke fun at me for something, you know. And what's interesting is the only place I can kind of touch into, a practice of being with the uncertainty in a dreaming type of way, and not in terms of my own dreams, but actually going to movies and applying it to the way I'm experiencing the movie. And it's an interesting practice because I've been doing it for a long time. It really has helped me work with uncertainty and kind of just put on hold my left brain wanting to figure it out and try to get to the end of the movie. So that's kind of my experience around this, what feels like we're talking about, how does a human being deal with the uncertainty and ambiguity, chaos in their life in any given moment, whether it's dreaming or waking, it seems to be.
Everybody's gone quiet.
Well, that's a good thing, maybe.
Well, we can be quiet by ourselves. We're here to engage.
That's true. But that does that mean that we can't have pauses in our speech and feel into each other when we're quiet and talk to each other in our silence?
Mark says no, so let's keep going.
Okay.
I suppose I can.
Well, as I said last time or something, and all of you weren't here, I live alone. This is my social life. For the most part.
Besides Psych Girl? Besides Psych Girl?
Yeah.
I wanted to tell you about a book I read, which was recommended by Jeffrey, the Ursula Le Guin book, The Lathe of Heaven. Just happened to be able to read this weekend. So it was related to dreaming. Essentially, to sum up the book, there's three characters, and one is an unknown man who is addicted to dream suppressant drugs because he has extreme dreaming, and enters the therapist, and he has this special machine that can make the individual go into the dream state immediately to kind of get through the therapy quicker, rather than just interpreting dreams and things like that. But you find out that they're actually changing the entire world. This guy, that's what made him crazy with his dreams. But I just wanted to mention it because Michael's been using the metaphor of the jellyfish, and that the book starts out with a pretty cool quote from that I wanted to read. But it says, current borne, wave flung, tugged hugely by the whole might of ocean, the jellyfish drifts in the tidal abyss. The light shines through it, and the dark enters it. Born, flung, tugged from anywhere to anywhere, for in the deep sea there is no compass, but nearer and farther, higher and lower, the jellyfish hangs and sways, pulses move slight and quick within it, as the vast diurnal pulses beat in the moon-driven sea. Hanging, swaying, pulsing, the most vulnerable and insubstantial creature, it has for its defense the violence and power of the whole ocean, to which it has entrusted its being, its going, and its will. But just like that is a beginning to a novel. So, thought I'd mention that. Yeah, I'm reading a book. I finished it.
Excellent, Doug. I like that.
Well, Marco appears in my dreams, not infrequently, or my dreams aren't really distinct, very in focus. It's like a representation of Marco, and some of it's, you know, it's not like he and I have a conversation. He's just some ghost-like representation. Yeah, my dreams are strange. They're not coherent stories, and I do have to take a good hard look at them. And oftentimes, I forget bits and pieces of them. And then when I had one, I think if a story or a dream repeats itself, I think it's worth taking a look at. And I had one since I could remember, you know, way back as a kid, and it stayed with me for till my mid-50s, and I have since, I got rid of it about 10 years ago. but it was a, and I had, that's not unusual that they, not exactly the same, but little bits and pieces. And then it seems if whatever it was, if I can resolve it somehow, then the dream goes away and it doesn't come back. Anybody else have things like that? Since we're sharing these private little dream states.
Really weird that I'm in your dreams. I just want to say, I'm afraid for you. I have something I kind of want to share. It's not exactly a dream, but it was a weird experience involving subtle and psychic energies or entities or forces or effects. And it's relatively recent and sort of part of the wave in my experience coming through the Gebser conference and then the cafe last week and various other meetings and encounters and conversations that we had. And I think it may touch on some of the themes that John brought up in toward the beginning around social dreaming and monetizing shit.
Other people's shit. Monetizing other people's shit while hiding your own. That, I think, is a widespread trend. Not here necessarily, but I mean, in the world we're in. Yeah.
Right. No, I understand.
Isn't that the definition of neoliberalism?
It's interesting that it was in a petri dish, yes. Though. And interesting that, you know, shit is microorganisms digesting food, like in some way. So the petri dish puts it in a place where it can be studied. Maybe something is learned from the shit.
I think Monsanto and Google would agree with you. Probably the Pentagon too. I think they'd love to study our shit.
Interesting. Yeah. So, all right. Well, I'm going to give them some material for the research purposes. So I've gotten, I can't, and prefer not to get into all the details, but long story short, I've gotten involved in a project which is requiring me to get up to speed on not just cryptocurrencies, but like browsing like on the internet, like undetectably and stuff, and connecting to, you know, like dark web sort of servers and things like that. And it's all okay. Like it's all fine as far as I'm concerned. Ethically and morally speaking, it's more kind of fun to do that stuff and to like actually, you know, be a secret agent and use end-to-end encryption on your apps and things like that. And it's basically a, you know, like a client project. I would be getting paid for this. And after the conference, I had this wonderful experience with my glasses where I felt I saw, or I kind of gained access to a dream realm, a sort of living dream realm that was a kind of real space. You know, it's still there. It's not, I haven't lost my sense of it. I think that it's real and it's active and it's effective. And it's part of Aurobindo's whole, I think, involutionary structure. You know, it's energies coming down and into manifestation. But part of what happened leading up to the conference and the events, which on the, you know, which were wonderful. I really enjoyed the time. I really enjoyed seeing Jeffrey and Heather and Jeremy, who really loves that book, The Lathe of Heaven, by the way. He said that that's his favorite Le Guin book. So I had this vision wearing the glasses, and that was wonderful, and I was enjoying it. It was very, for me, playful and fun, and a way of maybe testing kind of the interface, the intersections between different kinds of domains, because there is the monetization aspect. Like I want to put together a business plan, or the idea was, for these sunglasses, and then that really becomes a minor player in the bigger idea, which has to do more with communication and with creating conditions that allow different kind of sharing to occur that doesn't tend to occur in the bullshit waking world that we tend to be in, the consensus trance. So I was riffing on that and enjoying it, but at the same time, I had this creeping sense that, oh my, there's a lot of stuff that I'm not taking care of, I'm not doing. My to-do list is getting longer, my inbox is filling up, time is you know, coming down on me. It's sort of clenching down on me. And I had to get back to these you know, people with this project. I had other people to get back to. I was falling behind on the forum and conversations that I want to give attention to and want to absorb and respond to thoughtfully and creatively, like in the spirit of things. But basically what was beginning to happen was this mental sort of spiral, right, into time anxiety and time compression. And compounding all of this and complicating all of this, my computer crashed over the weekend. Last weekend. And it did so because I mindlessly initiated or accepted an update to the next operating system from Mac OS High Sierra to Mac OS Mojave. I didn't properly take the time for a backup. I didn't have my time machine set up. And I just thought, go for it. Like, let's upgrade. And trying to take care of shit, get shit done. I did it. Some kind of conflict occurred and the whole thing came to a halt. Everything stopped working. I spent hours last week trying to reinstall the system and get everything back up, you know, up to speed and working again. And in the midst of this, my list of things to do and our, you know, the economic stresses, like our budget, the money we have to spend, etc. All of this is beginning to impinge on that open, spacious kind of experience that I have post the conference. And then as a part of this, I had to kind of create an identity for this project. And I was having fun with it and I came up with, I thought, an interesting kind of idea, an interesting sort of character. And as soon as I thought of it, this kind of voice came into my head, this sort of like little impulse to claim it in some way. So like I wanted to, and I'll be very, this is my shit. Okay. So, you know, put on your gloves. Let's spray the,
you know, let me get my hat.
Put on a mask.
A raincoat.
Now, I quit social media, stop using Facebook, almost stop, pretty much stop using Twitter. You know, when we publish something on metapsychosis, if I'm in the mood for it, I'll post about it. But I've really sort of tried to curate my attention in a way that I feel is most aligned with the world that I want to see, the world that I feel wants to come into existence. I don't think it's coming into, I think that the domains of social media and this sharing that happens online, I think is exhausting itself because it's like shit upon shit upon shit. And there's nuggets of gold in the shit. There's genuine, I think, political uses for, you know, all of the technology, you know, from the Arab Spring to all kinds of organizing that it makes possible. Like, so there's a lot of questions, a big conversation to have about the pros and cons, etc. But I had a little voice in me that came right back up and said, oh, I should see if there's a Twitter account with this like cool little like character that I made up, because I would want to have that. And then maybe I could use it. Maybe I could, you know, parlay that into some kind of identity, you know, some kind of like, I don't know what it would be exactly. Like that was like the shadow element that came in. And so I quickly went and I saw that nobody had claimed this name. And let me just kind of grab it quick. There's, you know, the sign up box, enter your name, your email address and password, etc. So I quickly did it and came up, and then suddenly I had a new Twitter account and I had to fill out my profile. And so I thought, well, I need a picture, but what picture should I use? Now I'm on my iPad and I open up my photo app and I start scrolling through and I just scroll right back to the beginning. And there's a pic, and I find a picture of my mother. And she's young. She's like 20 in her 20s. I don't want to share it here, but I have to just say it's a beautiful picture. It's black and white and she's serious. Her hair is like this, right? So she had long hair, but I saw my soul staring back at me through that picture. I thought, oh my God, that's me. Like I saw, like I was in her being. And at that moment, as I uploaded that picture to Twitter, I suddenly got like seized by this. It's almost like a spear went through my body, but like I felt this, you know, my spinal cord like twist right behind the heart. And for the next, and still now I feel it a little bit, for the next 3 days, it was like my whole subtle body was broken. Like the whole connection, the whole flow from, you know, universe to ground, earth, the whole microcosmic orbit was broken. And it was like a hook or something just came through and cracked my spinal column, like right there. And I thought, oh, fuck. that was bad. I shouldn't have done that, whatever I did. And I felt a certain, like I've gotten, you know, I've had that, you know, spinal issues before from weightlifting or from other, you know, issues, but it had never been so tightly aligned with this psychic kind of process that I was experiencing. And I knew it would pass. So I'm not so worried about permanent damage or anything like that, but it was really almost a lesson to me because I still haven't fully recovered the clarity and that sort of access that I felt. And it became sort of a lesson in the, maybe, you know, the demonic or the, you know, the profane and the way that these clash with the spiritual and the divine and the visionary and how kind of like dangerous those admixtures can be, you know, like you can have these ab reactions in the alchemy. And so I thought it is shit, but it's worth sharing because I think it's, I mean, for me, it was a practical sort of learning experience and I'm still dealing a bit with it. And I'm still working. Like I love these sunglasses and I want to write about them and I want to use them as a muse and I want to bring forth visions through holding paradox in the sort of way that I think, you know, the magic would inspire. And so I like the idea of social dreaming a lot. And we don't really have the infrastructure for it. I think that's like in the waking world, it's not really set up to facilitate that. But I think that's part of what is wanted. I think that if we ask, well, what is Supramind trying to do? It's trying to create the conditions for its own being in the world. And like, this is what Katina is writing about in her thread on, I mean, she's seeing this through a Christian lens, but I'm seeing this like involutionary desire and that coming into contact and clashing with conditions in our, you know, consensus reality. And I think that relates to, I can't make a linear, like, you know, correspondence, but I think that relates to this dream that John shared at the beginning and the Petri dish and the panel and the universe of things. And yeah, so that's all. And maybe the lathe of heaven, like maybe our dreams are a lot more powerful than we acknowledge or tend to.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Thanks to everyone for developing this topic, which is so near and dear to my heart. But it's also extremely painful sometimes. That description you gave, Marco, of your mother, the picture of your mother and the Twitter account, and that, I think you said it was an arrow or a spear, and you felt it in the back, around the heart area. And you realized it was psychic rather than physical, or sort of a mix between the two. Yeah. I think this is what is of great interest as we, you know, good men, I think it's been said, have bad dreams. I think good women have bad dreams too, but I think since men are, it's harder for men to be good people than it is for women to be good people. This is my bias, and maybe very sexist of me to say this. But I think that the more we process our dreams and those demonic or very spooky kind of areas, I think that's what our imaginations are for. And we're less likely to act out in our daily lives violent programs. So that's my theory, and I think it's a widespread theory. I think a lot of people think this way who value dreams. But I'm also looking at something about the principles and the regularities that we're picking up on in our dreams and our waking lives and the interplay and the realities, the shared realities that we're creating today. And I'm remembering Terry Patton, who was a guest on the cafe, talked about the community of the competent. And I believe we've been experimenting with that principle. I think it is a principle. And I believe if we're paying attention to it, it becomes even more manageable, I think. And I think we get more competent at these skills of sponsorship and of co-sponsorship. Then we can let go of our anxieties around these shadow forces, which are not dangerous in themselves unless other people try to exploit us through that shadow by trying to drive you into a needy state. Oh, and this is why I'm not a therapist, although I think there's some splendid therapists out there. This is why I'm not a life coach. And this is why I have resisted the pharmaceutical companies and the medical industry. As a gay man, I abhor what has happened to my community by American Express and by the pharmaceutical companies. I think they've destroyed the gay community by this medicalization. And I've seen the tragedy of that. And I believe that it's there are nefarious forces out there that want your misery. And they want to create your misery, and then they want to claim that they can relieve you of it. I think this is where the impasse that our economy is at right now, as this gets more and more transparent to more and more people. Now, I'm not trying to, everyone has to make a living, and you do the best you can to live honorably and with integrity. And, you know, everybody makes mistakes, but I think it's the accumulated, let's just kick this can down the road because we can't deal with the tension of the paradox, the dilemma, the conflict. I think that's been done by many generations, and as many of the gifts that they've given to us, they've given us this one. Because there aren't that many generations that are going to be able to receive this can that we're kicking down the road and do something meaningful with it. So anyway, that's my challenge, because I much rather sometimes, you know, just hang out and do other things. But I feel a calling to come on here, even though it's sometimes inconvenient and there are other things I'd rather be doing. Because if there's any little bitty wiggle room where, you know, our social, our discourse can get more sophisticated and more competent, then I want to add to that possibility as much as possible. And I see, you know, lots of activity here that indicates to me that there's that's a shared impulse and drives a lot of our interest here. And I just want to
you know, those aesthetic relationships, if they were the driver, I believe, rather than monetizing someone else's misery, I believe we could really be much more effective at dealing with the binds and the double binds that we're in socially. Because I think there's a deep relationship between the private and the public. Right now, I think we tend to divorce the private and the public. And when you feel like shit, you think it's your fault, you've done something wrong, or you're a real loser. When actually, I think that people who feel that sense of failure may be just registering some larger malaise or dysfunction that has been widely ignored. So, thanks.
Suppose that's part of the reason I didn't want to convey any more information on anybody here or start some thread and say, let's talk about this topic for the cafe. I tend to like these open-ended sessions because we're going all over the place, but at the same time, we kind of emerge into some sort of thread of things. Another book I've been reading that I picked up was Sloterdijk. He's back in the picture for me, but I'm going for a smaller version. It just happened to be at the library today. But it's called What Happened in the 20th Century. And the first little talk that he gave, that it's been transcribed into text here, but it's the Anthropocene. It kind of explains what you were talking about there in his own form and fashion. But I was reading that earlier today, and it just reminds me of just everything that's going on in the world and the mentality of, like, we need immediate change, we need to do change, versus what are we to do about it? Let's stop and think about it. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I feel my presence here or the reason I stick around on this site is that emergent quality that comes up. We're not necessarily saving the world, but we're trying. We're trying in our own way. And this is a good hub for learning for me in general. Just thought I'd throw that out there.
So I have a question for you, Marco. Did you delete your new Twitter account, or you did? You got rid of it? I can't hear you.
I think that when I became clear, I had to do that. And even if it was only symbolic and it didn't mean anything, I think that was the pivot of healing. I think that, you know, that connection, that integration, that spinal integration starts to heal after that. And I think also my computer crashing, it's kind of like the way that I experienced it was like, if you've ever had antibiotics and it crashes your gut bacteria, you know, like you have a certain way of digesting things. And I think my technological infrastructure, computer, my iMac, my, you know, phone, etc., it's all part of this like digestive interface, you know, layers for information, for work, money, socialization or social experience. And having it all crash was like having to rebuild that gut bacteria or something like that. That's how it felt. Like I was just raw, you know, with default installations and with, you know, no preferences set and no, you know, none of the, you know, it's kind of odd to think about it that way, but it's part of an ecology, and it's like there's to think of it maybe more like organismically than, or ecologically than mechanistically. Like it's just these systems that all fit together. But in other words, that the systems could be healthier. There could be pathogens in the system. There could be cancers, like,
you know, by analogy, that is. So I mean, it's just getting me to re-examine, like, how am I really using all this? And, you know, how am I letting things like build up and become, ill, infected.
I like your ecological metaphor because it goes along with how I've had to recover from trauma and my surgeries. Same thing, somebody cutting into me and the disruption in my organic body rather than actually feeling into that and actually not honoring the mechanistic conceptualization that some people want to put on me about my relationship to this flesh. And one of the things I see that part of using that is how it resets the homeostasis of the system, of an organic system. It resets. When it's interfered with or shocked, there is a potential to, and I think it's creative, like DiMaso's last book, Strange Order of Things, he talked about how that enlarges the base of the homeostasis of organisms. And for me, it's a real task and you might say discipline, to use the phrase that I've been using lately, to trust that struggle that comes online, even from inadvertent situations that you described, Marco. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'm wondering, like, what, maybe, like, more on this, like, the social connection? Because,
well, the social connection is what he draws to is by individual human beings having this capacity that we're embedded socially, that we create culture out of our own it radiates out. Mm-hmm. Right now, the earth is going through, or human species is going through, a kind of homeostasis disruption. Mm-hmm. You know, and he, in the book, he just articulates all the way back, the strange order is that homeostasis came in line from two cells, or from a cellular level, that went up to a nervous system, created a nervous system, and then culture is kind of a externalization of our own nervous system.
Right.
So that's ecological. I'm just thinking, I'm roughly tying it with the way Bateson talks about the mind and ecology. Mm-hmm.
I haven't read Bateson myself. I know, John has brought him up a number of times. I mean, I part of what I'm sensing too is that, you know, our external reality before it is the reality that we experience of whatever ecological, social, political crises starts out as in our dreams and our visions. And it translates itself or sort of downgrades itself into material conditions through our actions and behaviors. And so if there is a dysfunctional or a pathological ecology, you know, that's come from a dysfunctional pathological psychology. And I think part of what I'm trying to think through has to do with how change or transformation would happen in that kind of model, that mm-hmm. understanding of things. Because, I mean, one thing I understand from I'm not a farmer, but we have we're friends with somebody who does farming, and they do biodynamic farming, mm-hmm. and they pay a lot of attention to the soil, to the living quality of the soil.
Right.
So it's not a mechanical process exactly. There's ways that you can supplement it. There's, you know, different practices, but the idea is to have a rich, healthy soil, because that's what actually will keep out invasive species, weeds, pests, things like that. If the soil is healthy, the plants will be healthy. They'll have their own defenses. And you don't then have to apply very drastic means like pesticides and other things to maintain the crop. So I mean, can we apply that same kind of thinking culturally and psychologically and spiritually? If we have healthy ways of circulating, processing, I don't have quite the language for it, our dreams, visions, if that's part of our social ecology, then we should be able to create pockets of health, relative health, even if there's a lot of dysfunction around. Mm-hmm. And that would have this radiating or this rippling kind of effect that I think you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you start on the other end and you look at the totality and say, like, what is the overall, you know, what kind of like massive changes do we have to make, like to, you know, economic systems and things like that? I think, I mean, that's been tried.
Yeah, it has.
And I'm not saying that that kind of metasystemic thinking is not important, but you know, somebody's got to be thinking about how it all works and fits together, I guess. But like as far as how change happens, or what even we would be, what I would be doing here, to me, what's most immediate is sort of the quality of the relationships and the quality of the discussions and the quality of my own experience. Like that's the most, and if that becomes wholesome, which is not to say, prudish or anything, just wholesome, then that's it, a lot. That's a lot to achieve, actually. I don't know how much more we can go for.
I also know that to do what we're trying to share, we actually somehow through modeling, or in my case, I think the trauma forced me to turn towards the dysfunction so I could change the dysfunction that, you know, rather than trying to numb myself, run away with it, even fight. I was more of fighting the dysfunction, which was put in me by my, and this is not a judgment against my parents, but there's certain things that took place in the family dynamic. The major one that I'm not afraid to share, my father was diagnosed with manic depression and when I was a teenager, and there were certain things that came out of his mental illness that I had to live through. And it's and again, I'm just going to go back to it. Certain traumatic events in my life sort of helped me reset to turn towards and actually trust that there is a way. But until we first just kind of maybe have a curiosity and an openness about what is this dysfunction about, if I could say it that way, because if we don't do that, I don't see how we can move to the vision that we're trying to enact, the vision that we're trying to speak to. Vision is good. I want a vision, but I've worked with other groups that come from a vision place, and we always had this tension because I'm a practical person. I get the intellectual vision, but you need to help chunk it down so I can walk the talk of the vision, if I can say it that way.
Yeah.
I think one of the things we need to remember is what's in the Petri dish is a culture.
Yeah.
It's a culture.
Yes.
And somewhere along the line, we decided that things were very mechanistic. So we looked at the universe as a machine and we said it's all very mechanical. And what we're coming to realize, I believe, is it's not very mechanical at all. It's really more akin to organic than mechanical. And it's difficult to accept the fact that everything, Katina pointed this out in her, let's create man in our image. That was one of her latest posts. Well, and there's been centuries, if not millennia, of debate about, well, what is that image? And that image was not mechanical. Not in the least. There was nothing there that could even apply mechanical. So it had to have been something organic. And in this organism-like thing, well, I think what it tells us, this is at least how I've understood that, is everything that we create as human beings, we create in our image, just like God created us. And it just kind of flows downhill. And so what we've created is actually organic, but we tend to describe it and want to assess it and grasp it mechanically. But you can't get a hold of it that way. You have to change your mind, the metanoia. You really have to change your mind and see, well, it is organic what we're doing. That's why the feeling that you have is real, even though there were implements involved, Marco. Whether it was a hook or a spear or whatnot, that's just some kind of gadget that was there. But those are the things that help us get along. But there's the reality of it goes way beyond the mechanical relationships between those. And that's the thing that I think that we keep missing and that we keep falling short of. It is, I learned this a long time ago, it is a digestive process. Everything we take in, we must digest. You know, I need time to think about it. We need to digest it. And if we don't understand how our digestion works, we end up with all the antibiotics that screw it up, that kind of debilitate all of that and actually reduce our ability to naturally combat the things that are attacking us. It's very helpful. This was a great advance. You know, I'm not against the antibiotics, not at all. You know, my wife went through a whole series. She had MRSA and was able to get over it. I'm surprised she's still alive in spite of all the medicine. But once you realize that it's not that, this is just a help to get to where you're going to go. We need to step back and realize that none of this is mechanical, just like your system upgrade and whatnot. None of that was mechanical. None of it.
If I may, John, this reminds me of the book, The Marvelous Clouds, because he's talking about getting back to an elemental teaching of media, because the original word of media way back when was medium, and they felt all the elements were a medium for creation. And since he marks the telegraph as the starting point of media, I'm paraphrasing, media as a gadget and man making artifacts out of the materials to help them do culture and help them exist. But we need to get back to the reality that we actually, the gadget came from the elements of Earth. And we can't lose sight of that. We need to bring that back on board. Thank you.
That's great, Michael. I haven't read that book, but I read, because you recommended, I read the chapter, the intro, and it's brilliant, really written. And I think that's a fascinating topic about how we interact with the material, and we create niches, and animals do this, and we do this, humans, and I believe we do it in very elaborate ways. I'm thinking about Jennifer Gidley's article, some of us have read, and we talked about it on the cafe, and recently Douglas brought this up, that she's written about post-formal education. And Douglas mentioned that he thought that's what we are doing here is post-formal education. And she's also a futurist. And I think that, I think it's in that article, she talks about the evolution of technology and how it starts out, like you're making a spear, right? And you have to have tools to make a spear, because you have to cut down a tree, carve it into a stick, and then you have to have another tool to sharpen a stone. You need a stone to sharpen another stone, and you have to, so then you have a spear. Then you have the bow and the arrow. which is a combination of the spear with something else added to it. And you have a community that's making this all work. It's not just coming out of somebody's head and some lucky individual. It's coming out of the desires and the interests of a large group, or a large enough group to make this kind of technology happen. And I think what we move towards, this evolution of technology, we start making tools that are actually for the mind, like a flute. That is a tool that actually influences the mind, or a sculpture, or a figurine, or a statue, or our art, dance and music. All of that is for the mind-body relationship and rhythm. Very important for our cultural capacities to be able to work with all of these different aspects of our nature. And I believe we're in this incredible technology, as has been mentioned by Marco and by many others. And I think this author that you were just mentioning, John Durham Peters, The Marvelous Clouds, which I'm looking forward to reading. We're in this explosion, really, of technology. And much of it may be very disconnected from, the environments that are being created are very toxic, and we don't know what to do with this. If it's possible, go for it. Let's do it. It's a very cognocentric society. But is it appropriate? That, I think, you need a body and a heart, mind, and a gut to coordinate the cultural dynamics in a way that's really ecological. And I don't think we're there yet. But I think there's enough people who are really making this front and center, and are paying so much attention. And I'm sure each of us every day is amazed by, I'm amazed by the insights and the understandings that are coming forward as this post-formal education that we're trying to sponsor here starts to flourish. I am more and more optimistic that we'll find a way. And we may be in this, some of us are dreaming about this post-money world, where the only thing that matters right now is profits and how much money you make. And the dark side of that isn't dealt with very well by most people. And that's why they end up doing drugs, getting into alcohol, or getting addicted to shopping or therapy or something to dissociate from that incredible malaise that alienation. So anyway, we have a lot of theories about this, and I'm thinking that this talking about Gidley's paper and post-formal education and Aurobindo, we've been studying Aurobindo. Let me see if I can get a little light. And I don't know if you can see this, but this is a ladder where it goes up and down. Can you see this, guys?
Yeah,
I see. Apologize if it's not clear. There's a ladder, and it's going up and down. This sort of reminds me of Aurobindo and Wilbur. Mm-hmm. They have a very ascending, descending metaphor, like the ladder. But then there's another metaphor. I think this is much more Gebserian. This is like a mountain climb. And you can see it's not just a linear ascent, but if you're climbing a mountain you've never climbed before, you can go up, you can go down, you can go around, you can go up again. You may eventually get to the summit, but it's not a linear sort of up-down progression. So I think that's sort of helpful, because I know I'm a very, I think that mountain, I think there is a direction in up and down, and I think our bodies are arranged in very hierarchical up-down ways. But I think there's also that meandering climb up the mountain where you go up and down. So it's not so clear what kind of progress you're making. So anyway, I'm just throwing those out as alternative kind of metaphors to play around with as we think about
it. I think it's like the shamanic journey that we all tend to go on, even if we're not consuming some sort of ayahuasca potion or actually a part of some tribe, but the general idea is you essentially throw yourself out there into the uncertainty, the unknown, or I guess with the ladder, that's more like Jacob's ladder. You're climbing, trying to figure out who that guy up in the clouds is. But the mountain is more of the shamanic journey where the member of the tribe is thrown out into the wilderness, exploring on their own, eating raw animal meat, perhaps, because he has to survive. And then he comes back after a week completely disheveled and not knowing exactly what to say. But by the time they're back, they have some sort of knowledge that they're trying to articulate. And it might be in some strange, crazy talk, but eventually it'll get through.
Yeah, I think that shamanic journey and the mountain, I think, are very related. And I believe it's very Gebserian, too, because I think Gebser appreciates that it's not just a linear climb to the top, but it meanders quite a bit, and that there are healthy and deficient forms of the magical and the mythical and the mental, and that the integration of previous structures are sometimes slippery. You know, it's not easy to know if you're making any progress on a daily basis, but maybe if you look back over a large chunk of time, you'll say, oh yeah, that happened, that happened, that happened, and I have a narrative now of transformations, of how they occurred. And the history of those transformations, I believe, is what Gebser and some of the authors we've been studying have been tracking. And I think we can notice that here on our own, in the couple of years we've been, I think the cafe's been about a year old, maybe a little over a year. I think we can start looking at the history of transformations that have been occurring, where there are little junctures where, you know, things were happening. There's a bifurcation point, choices were made, multiple diverse views were shared. And then I think the system either breaks down or it gets more complex and continues. So I hope we have more and more, our cultural capacities are getting refined and developed here. So we have a direction, but we also can recognize we're moving up this mountain and we've never traveled it before. And, you know, we're going to probably make some detours and get off the safest route and take a few risks. And then we'll get back on the route that's the best. So I'm just sharing that as a alternative metaphors we can use.
I think that's an important point, John, but it's not just the shamanic journey. That is the hero's journey of all mythology. It's that same process that you go through. It's not something special or different or exotic. It's something that every individual must go through. That's the part that I appreciate about Gebser, that he pointed out that mythology is true in a way that we don't, in the mental rational structure, wouldn't understand it to be true. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, you'd mentioned earlier that you like plans and you have to know where you're going and whatnot. I tutored strategy on an MBA program for almost 15 years. And the thing that I spent most time doing was disabusing my students of the notion that you can plan anything. And if you're going to practice strategy, you have to give up planning, period. What you need is a vision. You have to know that that's a mountain. And you have to know, just like you said, John, there's no straight way to the top. And if you're going to achieve your goal, whatever it is that you think it is that you're doing strategically, you're never, ever going to get there if you plan your way there. You have to have a good, solid metaphor of what that means and live the metaphor. And if you do, the decisions you make will be in tune with that metaphor. And you will probably advance even in those times when you are regressing and going back down, reorienting yourself, curving back up around the paths, because it's not a linear process. And planning kind of implies that, at least in most people's minds. And I can tell you, in MBA students' minds, it's very linear and quantitative. And it was a real challenge for me to try and impress upon them that I don't think that's not the way that it goes. You have to take another approach to that. And what I appreciate about what we do here in our, you know, in the cafes and in the discussions on Infinite Conversations is that we develop metaphors that people can attune with more than anything else. You know, I haven't seen anybody that's really come up with an answer to something or stated something so clearly that everyone agreed because, well, that's the way it is. But if we can bring it in tune with the metaphors that we've made for ourselves, then I think we have a lot of chance of making, I hate the word progress, but you know what I mean, kind of moving along in a way we'd like to go, if that's what I can say.
And listening to this conversation and paying attention to how my metaphors are forming in my brain, starting with John and then Ed, I'm thinking that as a metaphor, I think that a lot of this for me, speaking from my experience, is actually an impulse to defy gravity. I want to be Tarzan and swing through the trees. I don't want to take I want the struggle not to be too much of a struggle. I want to learn how to fly up to the top of the mountain with a helicopter versus climb, but I've enjoyed climbing up mountains because there's something different qualitatively when you climb up a mountain. But also, using my metaphor of gravity and being influenced by Alan Watson Taoism, I think it goes along with Ed, there's no straight line to the way the Tao moves. It wiggles, you know? And I love Watts's articulation personally as a thinking in his picture, ways he pictures it is, the biggest obstacle is we tend to use our conceptual mind to separate ourselves. That's the tool that we aren't honoring and using in an appropriate way. We've turned our conceptual faculty into a programming rather than an organic creation, from my experience. So I want to be Tarzan.
Yeah, okay. I think you're right, Michael. I can just add one thing. It's a very interesting. Back when I was doing my master's thesis in Germany, and I was trying to figure out how do we learn to read. There was a notion in psychology that we were beings that had a body, mind, soul, or whatever it was. And things were treated very organically. And someone very brilliant came up with the idea, well, the mind is like a computer.
Oh, God.
Yes. That was the metaphor. It was new. It was brand new. There was, you know, computers were just starting to arise and things were becoming. And so this idea, this metaphor arose that the mind is like a computer. And the only thing that, quote unquote, went wrong is that we've taken the metaphor literally, and yeah. Now we pursue everything as if the metaphor itself were the reality. Yes. But it has nothing really to do with the reality, but that's how we treat it. And so we've kind of inverted what we were talking about. And so we are having trouble, and that's why it always leads to some kind of dead end, because it was a helpful image at the time, but it's no longer helpful, and yeah. It's not getting us anywhere. So we need to forget that and unload it. But there are lots of folks who have invested a lot of time, money, energy, honor, and prestige, or whatever it is, into this metaphor and don't want to let it go.
Yeah, and I would just add that I'm aware of being aware of the limitations of the organic metaphor too. Because if I have to cut off my toe, I'm going to cut off my toe if it's going to save gangrene, you know, if it's going to keep me alive. So I'm totally on board. The metaphor of the organic, actually, I'm just thinking this right now, actually makes me honor the limitations of the metaphor more than a mechanical metaphor, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can't hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure the organic is a metaphor.
Okay.
That's why I'm right now.
Okay.
That's something I'm wrestling with. Okay.
And yeah, maybe it's a metaphor when, what is it, the strange order of things, when you can see the social structure and say, well, that's what's going on with the cells.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a hierarchy, but there's this porousness that even from a single cell, the way life is organizing all the way up to human nervous system is very similar. Very similar. Yeah, it's different, but there's a principle of the way single cells and multi cells will organize each other, will come to organize.
So I guess it comes to a matter of what we're dreaming of. We could be dreaming of electric androids, or we could be dreaming of the cell structure for our next building that we're building.
I think we could imagine
robots building it, I guess. I don't know.
Marco mentioned in another cafe, it's also paying attention to scale. The scale of things, you know, how things scale up and how they scale down. And the fact is the human being made up of what it's made up is always in the fucking middle. It's always in the middle. I don't care what you say. You're always in the middle of infinity, whatever that is. You know, I'm just saying, I'm always in the fucking middle, damn it.
I just wanted to add something. The idea of the linear and the nonlinear and complexity. And I think you mentioned this, Doug, about the crow and how the crow, I think it's in Japan, it hangs out at the intersection, and it takes a nut and he drops the nut at the intersection and it waits for a car to drive across it and crack the nut. It goes down at it and it eats it. Well, if you, and you know.
He drops it on the zebra stripes where the pedestrians go across and cars may not drive. It's more than just that.
So you know this story.
Yeah, I know this story. This is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
Because he knows it's a protected zone where he's dropping it.
So this crow with a teeny little brain has a strategy. It works outside of time. And it has a plan. And executes it pretty well. But it's working with that niche creation, construction. It's working with the environment. And I think that, so I think we are a continuation of what other animals are already doing. We're continuing that, and we're adding something extra to it. But I think our mind is coordinating the mind with nature. It's going to be important, I think, that there are enough of us who are sensitive to that. And that's why I like working with dreams, because I think we get really unfiltered information and it can zap you. And sometimes it's nightmarish and scary, and sometimes it's magnificent and it's wonderful. And sometimes it's just a mess and you can't make any sense of it at all. But I think if you pay even just a little bit of attention once in a while to those that other mind, I believe it can create, open a channel between these different dimensions so that we have a more multiphasic coordination can start to happen. And I believe if we make this an intention, then I believe we will come up with better and more interesting metaphors. As all metaphors, of course, have a short shelf life, and I think the computer as mind metaphor is definitely a bad one that we should have dropped a long time ago, even though it may have served a useful purpose. So, that I think many of us share, that fascination with language and mind and metaphor and narrative, and how important it is for us, those cultural capacities that we really, as a community of the competent, moving in that direction, we become very sensitive to these capacities and how, we might develop them further. So that's my main motivation in starting this alternate knowing dream group. To be playful with it. We don't have to save the world, but we might. It could happen. Stranger things have happened, that's for sure.
Just two little fun facts. Crows, like humans, I think there's one other animal species, are the only creatures who fight in formation. They actually make groups and plan their way of attacking others. That's on the one hand. The other one is that not all metaphors are short-lived. Jacob's ladder has been around for quite a long time, but the fun fact about that is we don't know that it's a ladder. The word that's used to describe that in Hebrew appears absolutely one time and one time only in the entire Bible. So it might be a ladder and it could be a staircase, but it might even be a ramp. It's just some way that you can ascend and descend, whatever that may be. And it's also not very clear who exactly or what exactly is going up and down. And the thing that comes up at the end when Jacob realizes whom he's dealing with, there's nothing in the text to indicate that God, if you will, is standing at the top of that ladder. It's just as easily understood that he's at the bottom with the rest of us.
Yes! Love it.
Just a quick note. Yeah, and going off of that, I listened to a brief interview with Ursula Le Guin and maybe Bill Moyers. I don't know. But she noted during that interview that the Lathe of Heaven, that the translation she took from the Tao Te Ching that a lathe was not actually produced at that time. So there's your mechanical reference there. So she said, well, it's in the book. I might as well just say it.
Well, just playing with metaphors, and I think metaphors have shelf life depending on the context, because sometimes you use them in different places too, and they're not appropriate. But one of the most ancient metaphors that I understand from indigenous society is weaving, dream weaver, weaving our reality and how we weave it. And I like that metaphor because it has to do with what are we doing with our hands and the material? What are we conceptualizing? Is this going to be a basket or is it going to be something else? You know, and this whole notion that I've really taken a fancy to is how much hands and eye coordination helps us to actually be creative with our own concepts. It's really important, grasping things. And I've worked in maintenance most of my life, and I know a lot of problems I solved was touching things and then stepping back and going, oh, this is what, you know, I can relate. I've had to have my hands do one thing and my eyes and my brain and my mind work and dual focus. And I've just been spending the last few years of trying to do that with people in some way.
I missed what you said, Marco. Sorry.
Oh, I suggested that we add Lathe of Heaven to our...
It's pretty short. It can be managed within a weekend or talk about it within two sessions or something like that.
I disagree completely. You can read it in a weekend, but you can't discuss it in a day.
That's why I get two sessions.
Good point. Well... we'll see what comes up. I mean, one other, like we still have some Aurobindo to read. I'm not in a rush to do more reading or kind of add more books to my list. I think that part of what I feel like is needed or what I, you know, for myself certainly, is to digest. We've had a lot of conversations, been a lot of ideas, a lot of metaphors. And I keep coming back to the chunk down and chunk slow, which Johnny has introduced, and which for me is a sort of a antidote or something to my, you know, to a countervailing tendency towards speed, you know, that, and towards, you know, sort of getting there, like getting to the end, getting to the next level, getting to the next manifestation. And that's not the way things happen. You know, that's not the way organic things happen. You can build a vehicle and on a production line, and it'll take whatever, but you can't grow something in the same manner. Something that grows has to take time. And that's, I think, that's one of the axes, or that's one of the elements of the struggle aspect, is the time dimension. Like, how do we experience, and how do we, it's hard, the language is hard here. I mean, that's why Gebser had such a hard time, but because I want to say manage time, right? But then we're treating time as this resource that you have to allocate in certain ways. At the same time, it is kind of like that. Like, you have, in some objective sense, a linear objective sense, you have 24 hours in a day, and the way that you occupy those hours is kind of how your life ends up. Like, that's if you chunk it down, that's how it is. I saw an article in the Times that was about a book comparing time realists and time optimists, and the idea being that time realist is conservative with their time. They look at a task and how long it's going to take. They don't overschedule themselves. They tend to manage their time better. Whereas optimists always think that there's more that can be done than actually can be done in a given amount of time. And it's like part, you know, we are living in a time of this influx. There's an influx of energy, right? The eruption of time that Gebser talks about. I've seen the same kind of thing referred to in Sloterdijk and elsewhere as an invasion of the infinite. Like you were saying, Michael, about just being like in the, just, you know, stuck between your finitude and the limits, the inherent limits to being an organic being, an organism, and then the infinity that you're open to by virtue of that, by virtue of consciousness, I guess, ultimately. So it's like a crucible that I think we're in, where the infinite wants to be in the world. The infinite wants to be reflected and wants to play in matter. Like, this is where it gets real. This is where it really can, you know, work with things, shape things. And it's using us, in a sense, to do that. So we're, you know, we have to negotiate our agency with respect to the, you know, the agency of the infinite, essentially. Like, I don't know that it has a separate agency apart from like our embodied agency, but those are the forces that I think are at play. And I think it's part of why the metaphors are important as well, because a machine or a computer as a metaphor for that larger process is gonna, well, constrain like how that energy can move, right? So, maybe a quantum computer wouldn't, like, maybe the mind is a quantum computer. That would be the next metaphor, because that, you know, and those are gonna trounce our current computers. Like, they're saying that all of our encryption, our whole our whole infrastructure is gonna be destroyed by quantum computers, which are not limited to binary states, which can exist in multiple states. So that perhaps becomes, I don't know how the legs that metaphor will have. Or what that reality looks like. But I mean, I think part of what we're doing in this like social dreaming is, maybe we're starting to create maps of like the intermediate realms, like between in this involutionary flow, right? Like none of us are technologists in the sense that we're going to build the next machines or going to build, but perhaps we can create more of the like the cultural or the mental conditions where the next machines are not as, you know, destructive or not as limited as the ones that we have now. I'm just thinking around like what would be a visionary purpose like to what we're doing. I think that culture creation, like which shapes our inner worlds, maybe that's part of what we're working on, or part of what Supermind is working on.
I want to respond to that. There's so much going on here. We were talking about time, and if you like, have a little, I'm sure you guys have done this, you have a little pie chart, and you divide it up, you know, shopping, eating, writing in your journal, reading, hanging out with your family. Mm-hmm. That was your day, and that was what was important to you. Sometimes people are working and it's 8 hours of their day and they don't have time for friendship or family. They don't have enough money to go out and party or to buy gifts or do acts of generosity. So they're very constrained. But we all sleep about 8 hours a night. So I think that the rhythms of the economy are pervasive, and I think they are shortchanging us. I think the quality of our relationships and of our attention has been suffering a lot the last couple of decades since computers have taken off. But I think we need to face the reality that I think it's 30 or 40 corporations have more money than any nation state. So we're talking about armed revolution is not going to happen. So what are we going to do if we want to live dignified, satisfying lives when so much is stacked against that from happening? And you mentioned the intermediate. And you were talking about technology, Marco. But I think the intermediate is also being expressed in that metaphor you used of the spear that entered your spine and the heart level when you had that image of your mother and posting it on Twitter. I think that was the subtle, physical, a little of both. That's the intermediate range that most of the tantric masters make the front and center in their attention. It's those very subtle dynamics that are happening between matter and mind and breath that I believe we've lost in our addiction to this cheap, gaudy shit that we just think we gotta have more of. And I believe that's soul level stuff that we have to bring into the mix somehow. And can we use this technology? I'm not talking about, I think, the traditional ways of dealing with oppression. I think we have to really look at differently, because I don't think the kind of oppression that we're dealing with now is commensurate at all. So I think this is a brand new territory, an unknown territory. We're climbing up an unknown mountain here. So I'm just saying, let's use all of our knowledge and use all of it well. Definitely, I'm not a Luddite. I think we're using this technology today in this conversation in a very effective way, because we're dealing with the intermediate zones and we're putting into words probably stuff we've never really put into words before. And I believe if we challenge each other to do more of this and do it better, I believe we're all our cultural capacities are going to be enhanced. So that's my spiel. Thanks.
I love it. I agree, and thank you for sponsoring some of that work and some of those activities. And there's a lot to be done.
One more thing, and then I'll shut up. If there were more people who were sensitive to this intermediate subtle area where the imaginal and the physical interact, what kind of technology would those persons be sponsoring? And I think that's very hopeful. If there are more people who were able to interact in that way so sensitively, I think it would be a different relationship to technology than is dominant now in our AI fantasies about going off to the moon and going off to Mars and colonizing the rest of the galaxy in the next 1,000 years. I mean, they're talking seriously about this.
Yeah, if you study the subtle, you can do that without a spaceship. You know.
Yeah, but where do you put the garbage, Michael?
You know, okay, Ed. I got it. Where you put the garbage?
It's a pretty big void we've got up there. You can just toss it wherever.
The garbage is just energy. You come up with a compactor to recycle the energy or something, you know. Or maybe it falls very Dallas is create the least amount of garbage, the least amount. Be conservational with the way you use your energy, no matter on what spectrum you're using it. I mean, I feel strongly about this because that was my lesson when I was a bouncer at the coffee shop, is I had to streamline my energy because I didn't want the garbage of getting into the fight and causing a bunch of shit. I want the least amount of shit.
But remember, the shit in that Petri dish.
That's right. That's right. That's right. I can't forget that. It's good compost. I mean, you put it back in the soil and it builds more microbes and it goes back into the soil. You know, I just don't want the big pile of shit.
I mean, there are those like super resistant bugs. I think Ed, your wife had one of those?
Yep, she did.
Well, one of the therapies for that is enemas of other people's shit.
Wow.
Because you want to introduce the beneficial bacteria. And kind of recolonize the gut. Wow. Because otherwise it's almost intractable. My wife actually had C. diff after our child because she got doused in antibiotics, and it was necessary. She needed that to save her life and save our daughter's life. But that's one of the consequences, side effects of the, the over-application or overuse of antibiotics is you get these super bugs and these hyper-resistant pathogens. So there is, though, a use even to somebody's shit, as long as it's healthy shit.
Yeah, well, not too much. I don't want a large portion of it.
Leave it to the professionals.
That's right. That's the problem with our society, Michael. We get too much other people's shit.
Well, and also when I worked for California State at Lake Paris during the summers, I had to do the Kimmy toilet corp. So, you know, I have firsthand experience with people's shit. Good one. And the smell is the worst thing. Actually, the smell is just, whoa, whoa, whoa. And on a hot summer day, it's the worst.
Fun fact about smell.
Yeah.
There was a guy who had some kind of a disease or an infection. And for about 6 months, it was said in the thing that I read, I can't even remember where I read it, that he smelled like a dog. Yeah. And then he was cured he wasn't real happy about it at the end because they said, well, what was that like? He goes, there are no bad smells.
Wow.
They're just different. Wow. And they're very, it's very important. Only we think things smell bad. Dogs don't smell bad things. They just smell. That's how they create their world, you know?
Wow.
And I just said, well, that's an interesting approach to this because we're very quick to label good, bad, or indifferent or whatnot, you know? But maybe there aren't bad smells. They're just intense, less intense.
Yeah.
Whatever. Just a thought.
On Netflix, they had a show called Sniffer. It was done in Russia. This guy was a detective sniffing out clues. I'm not shedding it. It just blew me away. And it goes to show that everybody may have a certain sensory gift that, like you say, we couldn't even handle. But for some reason, it's a gift, and they learn how to use it.
I think if you look at a dog, they have those long snouts, and they have bad eyesight, but their smell is so much better than ours. They can detect very subtle ranges. That's why we need dogs, you know, to sniff out things in airports or in earthquakes or wherever. They're very sensitive.
Their
vision is bad.
Their vision is bad. I saw a documentary yesterday on German TV about dogs, and it was said that they smell 40 million times more intense than humans. Yeah, it's absolutely unfathomable what they do. And they did these blind tests where they sent people through water, whatnot, and whether the dog could find where they had hid in the cities or whatnot. And the dogs, you know, invariably came up with the right person at the right time. They're absolutely fascinating in that regard, but they have other limitations, you know. So, you know, yeah. And so we get together. That's when I worked here on the border. There was a dog handler. He trained the dogs on the border for their border patrols and whatnot. And it was absolutely amazing what the combination of a dog and a human on patrol could do. That neither one of them could have done on their own, but it was in the combination between the two that was so effective.
Well, I remember working in a dog facility for dogs who were very damaged, junkyard dogs, who were kind of crazy because they might like people, but they hated other dogs. And, you know, when you took out one of these dogs to walk them, like in the park, they had to be muzzled because they'd see another dog, especially a male, and they would want to kill it. And so these are big, you know, big Labradors, you know. And it took me a while to sort of enter into their culture and to start working with socializing them with other animals. And some of the male dogs who had been found in junkyards, you know, they had been very abused from very early. And so they were pretty hardcore. But you know what? I remember this one time I was out at the park and I sat down on the park bench and there were no other dogs around and I took the muzzle off and, you know, he was, chained to the bench. So I know he couldn't run off. And I remember just putting my arms around him, you know, and feeling his heart. And, you know, he was just going, you know, he was just being a dog. And I just felt this killer who hated other animals, but he was very devoted to me. And I just felt this animal kinship, you know, with this generous, wonderful creature, you know. But I think that's, and I worked with other dogs, also these little lap dogs. I worked for, it was a gay organization, took care of the celebrities who had their little dogs who had come into this nursery. Because if they were left at home, they would tear up the furniture and everything. But I had this wonderful experience of, I would became the alpha dog. Once they knew I was the boss, they behaved. And all I had to do was pick up the broom and raise it over my head as if I were going to hit them. I didn't. But they knew that I could. And they would stop yapping. And then I would sit and I would meditate. And
half of them got on the left, half of them were on the right, and they would cross their paws and they close their eyes. And here I was with these little lap dogs who were totally unmanageable, but they were all meditating with me. And I remember the boss came in and he just like, what's going on here? He said, he was really freaked out because he's never seen anything like it. And I'd never seen anything like it either. But I learned a lot. You know, I think animals are very, especially dogs and cats, they're very tuned to us. And, you know, if they act nervous and erratic and crazy, that's because what we're doing. We're erratic and crazy, and they pick up on that. But if we're mellow and chilled out and relaxed, they will do that too. So I'm just saying that may be something for some future cafe. We could talk about animal communication. I think Gregory Bateson did a lot of, he worked with dolphins and animal communication. It's fascinating research that he did. So I'm just hoping that we could all, you know, think about potential, you know, research creation together, what we could do to research stuff and come up with some more interesting cafes in the near future. Just today, I think there are half a dozen topics we could pull out of this conversation today and think about, you know, future cafes. So thank you all for this opportunity to share.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to get going. It's been a couple hours.
I just want to briefly mention in 2 weeks, I'll have another attempt to sit down and not have to jump off after an hour. So I'll put together one in 2 weeks.
Oh, good. Cool. You have a topic?
Something around Jennifer Gidley's space and maybe post-formal education, but we'll.
I think that's a great idea.
I'll see how it ties up. But like you're saying, there's a lot of loose ends right now, so we'll see.
I think if we were to go back to past cafes, to topics that were only developed on the forum, I think we'd probably find a lot of material, a lot of loose ends and things that we could weave together into new insights. I think that's part of what we're doing. John has said this too before, like we don't need that much more. I still do want to read the foams, Sloterdijk foams, and there's, you know, I have an endless reading list. I'm not so much in a rush to read a lot of things, but because we have so much already to work with, and I think that we can be, you know, we can get clearer with what we already have. We can sort through our own shit, if you will.
We've done, as readers, a lot of heavy lifting. And I think after this Aurobindo read, we can maybe spend some time integrating all the different authors we've read and do a little comparative study, because we're now in a position to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't a year ago.
Yeah.
I think that could be a great contribution to our development if we could take a little time to do that.
Yeah. There's definitely this area of comparative integral philosophies that could be further fleshed out. Rudolf Steiner would be wonderful to read. Teilhard de Chardin we haven't brought in. And there are other philosophers, 20th century, who've been, a couple hundred or so years, who've been pretty neglected, that we could bring in. Aesthetic philosophy.
Bergson.
Oh, yeah, Bergson's. Suzanne Langer is another one, a name that's come to mind. My feeling is that things are accelerating, things are happening fast, but we don't have to go along with the speed of things. You know, at the same time, we can't ignore them. I think that things are in this process of hitting the fan. And there's a certain amount of, caution. You know, we have to have, like, historically things are going to happen. Things are happening. And, you know, with a young family, it's something I really pay attention to. And I like that we have, though, a protected space in where we could slow down and do the integration work that maybe a lot of other parts of the culture aren't doing.
The metaphor that comes to mind, we've digested a lot and we just need to move to the living room and drink some wine and sort it out. you know, bring it together, and then we'll grow our separate ways, and we'll each crap it out whatever way we can.
Yeah, sounds like a plan.
Thanks, Michael. All right.
Bye.
Bye, bye.
Mark, Jabor, are you okay?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Cool.
See y'all next time.
Bye, bye.
See you tomorrow. See you tomorrow, John and Doug.
And Doug, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Bye, bye.
Bye, bye, all.
Anybody else that wants to join?
Thanks.
See ya.